Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Network podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler, host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Cynthia Parker Anoyi, author of the book, Daughters of Harriet. How are you doing today?
Great. How are you?
Great. I wonder if you could begin by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
So in my work life, I'm a therapist, and I've been working in the nonprofit community for many years. But I've always wanted to be a writer. I've always written. And so I decided back in the arts that I was going to apply to an MFA program so that I could further my writing skills and be able to produce a book. And so I completed the MFA program, and that began my trajectory on the road to writing. And so I became interested in doing this book based on my childhood narratives and just the general day-to-day issues surrounding Black women.
How did you decide on the title, Daughters of Harriet?
So when I was in the MFA program, my thesis director, my mentor, and also my friend now, Brenda Hillman, suggested that I should use the title of the poem in my book, Daughters of Harriet. I initially had a different title for the book, Her Marked Black Body, which is also a poem in the book. But it seems as though that Daughters of Harriet got across better what I was trying to get people to feel in the book, the history of Black women in America from slavery to the present. And so Harriet Tubman, who is my hero, it's the reason why that I wrote the poem Daughters of Harriet, and I wanted to make the book representative of what Harriet was trying to do as an abolitionist.
Can you tell the audience about the girl back in Telemark?
So, Girl Black in Kilmarnock is a childhood narrative, my narrative, about summers in Kilmarnock, where my mother was born and raised in Virginia, and what it was like being with my grandmother and my great-grandmother in Virginia, and what life was like for them through the Black experience living on a farm. And also the Kilmarnock, the house that my mother was born in and where I would go during the summers, is like my family's ancestral home. So you will see that I talk about Kilmarnock a lot throughout the book.
Can you read my favorite poem, My Mother the Lunch Lady?
Sure. My Mother the Lunch Lady. Each day at 8 a.m., my mother, the lunch lady, works the assembly line of newly made meals, each a stamp of mass, scratched from the unlimited land of heather and sunflower risings. She reaches home at 3, after a day of patriarchy, whose offspring depend on her to be coddled, each her presumed favorite, a maid at school, her face erased from her colored, marked body, universally misseen, misnamed. After school, I watch her in her bedroom, removing her school clothes, collecting her uniforms for the wash, her handkerchief shaped like a dolly on her uniform's lapel with the name Dot inside. I don't know her as this woman, a black woman whose birth is tied up in her labor. She labors for the small coins to use her black body as surrogate for elevated white women who insist she nourish what whiteness has wrought, manage their childish fears. Miss Anne said, "Be Hattie, be the wind, be Mammy for 8 hours while they are in preparation for future domination." They have the power my mother could not imagine. At home, Dot is taking what is not really quiet time, but in the slimmest of single moments within the enclosing generational chasm of servitude and place. In these moments, she belongs to no one. She says it is her nerves. She needs to fight for her life in a life where she is owned by the state, her husband, her daughters, the church, the community, who say that she is the very nice lady with a smile who exists to serve lunch at this unintegrated school, the lunch lady with cancer. Cancer that silenced, sank her until she retreated with her voice. The labor, the black female body she couldn't corral, but succumbed when home meant gone.
Thank you. The Oppression Table, Genesis. Can you read that poem for us? And what were your thoughts after writing this poem?
Sure. The Oppression Table's Genesis. Black is not the desired color of women. Black is too loud. It needs a touch of something to mute her boisterous nature. Black is not the desired color for women. Bible is black. Bible is not monogamous. But Bible wants her to love him only. And Bible will only promise love at gunpoint. So this is a poem that I wrote in response to how religion is used in oppression, in structural oppression, and how black folks and black women in particular are use the church as a way to cope with the day-to-day issues of subjugation and exploitation. And also, religion, Black people were seen as not being religious, and that they needed to be provided with or forced into accepting Christianity as a way of civilizing a Black person who was considered a savage. And so I wanted to talk about how, as Black women, even though we're not any of the speakers in the Bible, we figure prominently in the Black church, even though we're generally not the minister, but we maintain and we keep the Black church going. And I wanted to show how, through using religion at gunpoint, is a way to explain some of the oppressions that Black women face in the church, and how the church affects how one is perceived in society.
Another favorite poem, Greyhound Bus Station, 1950. Please read this to the audience.
Yes, Greyhound Bus Station, 1950. And this is a true story about my mother, who, when she left Kilmarnock, Virginia, went north, of course. And this was a job she had at 19 in the Greyhound Bus Station. B, the gift shop sales clerk wore the scent of Virginia on her feet. She walked hard, like farmhands do, but she was beginning to understand northern habituals, going to beauty shops, buying greens at Food Barn, dropping her ahras. But Jim Crow wouldn't leave her alone. He kept showing up when she tried on sassy chartreuse hats with 9-inch feathers bowed around the brim for Wednesday 5 o'clock service at Enon Baptist. Lucky Brown Cosmetics, Red Savoy Pumps at Florine's, the May Company's policy did not allow grease stains on the merchandise. So she stepped over to Sapphire's Brim's Wee Crown colored heads. At the station, she left the change for white customers on the counter, Black skin leeches. Yet her pride was in the display. Travels with white aunts, see New York City on $1 a day. But she knew her station, arrived here at 19 to attend a colored school for colored women. The station master felt a colored sales clerk would better serve their customers as a domestic in the back, like her ride up south.
Beautiful. What's behind that?
So, my mother used to always talk about how when she left the South and she had come to the North to attend college, and she got a job at the Greyhound bus station so that she could have some money to live off of as a college student. And when she went to work at the Greyhound bus station as a sales clerk, a lot of the white customers complained about a Black woman being visible out front for everyone to see, providing services for the public. And they felt as though, you know, why isn't she a domestic? Why isn't she cleaning the Greyhound? Why is she working as a sales clerk? And so I wrote about that because, and that was a story I'll always get her to tell me over and over again, because I thought that, yeah, this is a part of our history. This is a part of being a Harriet.
Thank you. Colored Hats. Please read that story.
Sure. Okay. Colored Hats. A type of mirror discriminates. Behind absence stumbles the power. Conflicts jerk black room before spoiled milk. Black room conforms. Toes the line next to the old truth. How does the black room perceive an item? Why can't black room shove the living mercury? Black rooms without closures, listen moral. A dogma sickens underneath. Black room cues outside its box. Barrels a tunnel. A policeman explodes. The heart smells through any bay. Burnt air guides a groan. How does black room pale with the poetic sunrise? Black room revolts against the eagle.
Tell us about what's behind that poem.
So there's a book by Gertrude Stein called Tender Buttons, and she uses a lot of inanimate objects to explain how she perceives the world, and she assigns meanings to these inanimate objects. And I decided to use that format and describe how Black folks are, again, deal with oppression and subjugation. So, for example, when I say a type of mirror discriminates, what I'm saying is that it's a reflection of the cruel systemic oppression since the invasion and pillaging of Africa that is the foundation of this nation. Behind the absence of humanity is a world power, America. Behind this absence of Black humanity is the entitlement to my life, to Black life, to be owned, legislated as 3/5 human, as property tax for slave owners. In the poem, Black rooms represent Black folks. Living mercury is effective as an active ingredient in skin whitening, a compound used to depigment skin. How does black room pale with the poetic sunrise? Blackness doesn't pale. It colors everything. And when I end with the black room revolts against the eagle, I'm talking about resistance to oppression in the U.S.
You also wrote a poem, Negro Buys a House. Can I get you to read this one?
Negro Buy a House. The collective whisper began on April 2nd, 1965, in the 1400 East Independence Avenue on the truck. A family of four transporting housewares, various and sundry negrobilia, along with heavy chintz furniture with knotted plastic coverings. The collective neighbors catacorner to shaded windows, elongated green telephone cords on rotary phones, signaling to their neighbors that what they had overheard at the local Woolworths was indeed true. Each neighbor waited with the newest of Negro detectors. These Negroes had mobbed into Montgomery Heights like swarms of roaches, bred 2,000 at a time in secret colonies. One neighbor even swore that she saw the heads of the Polk family over on America Crossroads in the eddy of a fiery cauldron for sale signs. Flat furiously atop newly dug sod. By noon, a transformation had occurred. The family toting Britannica encyclopedias, a red and white mica table set, and 1959 blue Chevy was officially a ghetto.
Tell us the significance of that poem.
So this is a poem that I kind of use humor to get across. So like back in, I would say probably going back as far as you can go back once Black people were free, that once a Black family moves into a neighborhood, overnight that neighborhood is transformed. And there may have been white families living in that neighborhood, but once the first Black family moves into the neighborhood, it transforms, and now it's become known as the Black community, and Black folks are seen as bringing down property values, which impacts community schools. So it's really a fear of what is known as of the fear of a Black hat. Once you have one come in, meaning that 2,000 roaches, you know, they're going to be 2,000 more Black families to come in into that community and take it over.
And what are the messages that you want to leave the reader with after reading this great book, Daughters of Harriet?
You know, the thing that I want most when people read this book is to feel. I want folks to feel what I'm trying to get across, because I'm interrogating the psyche and emotions of an oppressed people that continue today, and the roads that Black folks have to walk just to try to get freedom, to even be perceived as human. And so I wrote this with hopes that folks could feel or have feelings or some type of feeling about what it's like through the Black experience in America.
Well, I've taken up a lot of your time. What is the next project you'll be working on?
Oh, okay. Actually, I'm working on fiction. And I'm also working on another poetry book. So, yeah, I'm trying to put those two things together, and hopefully I might have something to put out there in a year or so.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that new project. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Deidre, for having me. I so appreciate you.